He steals all my good points, and he uses them. So I stole this from him. He doesn't know it yet, but I'll tell him. Probably three of the most important men in the Bible, not the most important, but certainly the most important, would be Moses. I would consider him to be important. I would consider David to be important. And I would consider the Apostle Paul to be important. And yet, all three of these guys were murderers. Now, I've done a lot of wrong in my life, in my Georgetown days, but I didn't murder anybody. And yet, here are three men. We have some more if we have time. Here are three men that the Lord used and used to his glory. So I'd like to talk about Moses. What an interesting guy. And you know, the more I read about Moses, not only Moses but David, it's like they become your friend. You could sit down and just have a good conversation with them. But Moses was born, as we know, in Exodus 2. He was born to his parents, of course, whose names are escaping me at the moment. I didn't bring the Jochebed and Yoshebel. Amram and Yoshebel. I knew that. I just don't have my Old Testament notes up here. Anyway, after 3 months, they saw, he was a beautiful child. And Pharaoh had decreed that all the boys be thrown in the Nile. The girls could be saved, but the boys had to be drowned because the Jews or the Hebrews were becoming too powerful and too numerous. So Moses' mother wrapped him in a cloth and put him in a basket and set him adrift on the Nile. And there Pharaoh's daughter picked him out of the water. By the way, Pharaoh's daughter knew that he was a Hebrew, unlike the movie. No, she was aware that he was a Hebrew. And Moses' sister watched him as he was put in this basket and picked up. So she said, "You want me to go find someone to nurse the child?" And of course, that's exactly, she went and got Mom. So as this lady draws Moses out of the water and gives him to his mother to raise. His mother, of course, tells him all about his heritage and the promise to Abraham and so forth. And by the way, Pharaoh decides to educate this child and to educate him in such a way that he knew everything about the Egyptian culture, whether it was math or science. Moses would have been, in his day, probably a PhD. So it was this man that when he was 40 years old, finally went out and saw that an Egyptian was beating up one of the Hebrews. So Moses went out. You've got to kind of put yourself in his position. This is not the gentlest man in the world at this point. At least I never got that. Because he looks this way, and he looks that way, and he kills the Egyptian. It takes some anger to kill somebody. Oh, okay.
Josephus tells us that Moses was actually one of the commanders of Pharaoh's armies and was responsible for subduing a couple of different kingdoms.
Right.
So at this point in time, he's basically a soldier. So I can see why this might be easy for him to do.
Yeah, he was mighty in works and deed. He was a powerful man. Could have been a general. And if you've ever met generals, and I used to drive for one for a while, they have their own air to breathe, I think. They don't think like we do. They're pretty self-confident. But Moses sees in his 40th year now, it's taken him 40 years to sort of maybe going to do something about the Hebrew problem. And he sees this Hebrew or this Egyptian abusing a Hebrew, and he kills him. The next day, The next day, he tries to break up a fight between two Hebrews. And one of the Hebrews tells him, "You're going to do to me what you did to the Egyptian?" And Moses said, "Oops, the jig is up, and I need to get out of town." And it was that 40 years that Moses was in Midian as a shepherd for his father-in-law Jethro that Moses became the gentlest man in the world. And now he's gentle and he's patient. And if anybody ever needed to be gentle and patient and at the same time have a backbone of brass, it was Moses. It was tough enough to deal with Pharaoh. And then he had to deal with the Hebrews, who were probably in the long run as much trouble as Pharaoh was. But it made him, after this killing and his escaping to Midian, which, by the way, is Saudi Arabia today, made him the man that God needed to get the children of Israel out of Egypt and into the promised land. It's a great story, but here, Moses being a commander, killing a man, going off 40 years, and then God, now he has spent enough time that God can use him for his purpose. Not quite enough room up here. And Moses did indeed become the gentlest, meekest man in the world. Next guy I want to look at. And we could go through Moses and all his trials and all that, but it's just that, you know, here's one of our heroes, and he's a murderer. He goes away 40 years, and then God recycles him. God uses him to his for his purposes. Yes?
And through all of those experiences, God shaped him into who he wanted him to be.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes when we come to a point in our lives, instead of merging gently into something else, we make an abrupt right turn and go some other direction that we had never imagined we would go in. We should carefully consider what God's trying to teach us in that, yeah, that experience.
You know, and Moses, for the first 80 years of his life, he didn't have the law. All he had was the law of knowing right from wrong. And apparently at one point he chose what was wrong. He killed the Egyptian. It's interesting what the Hebrew writer has to say about Moses. If I can find it here quickly. It says by faith in Hebrews 11. Everybody knows the faith chapter. Hebrews 11, 23 and forward. It says by faith Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents because they saw that he was a beautiful child, and they were not afraid of the king's edict. But Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. This would have been around his, as I understand, around his 40th year, choosing rather to endure ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, considering the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking to the reward. So Moses then knew that these people had a promise, the Hebrews had a promise that the Egyptians didn't have. So he said, even though I can be fabulously wealthy here in Egypt and have all that I want, rather he chose to suffer with the Hebrews and enjoy the reward at the end of his life. It's kind of interesting because on the Mount of Transfiguration, who does Jesus see? Who does he talk to? Moses and Elisha. So Moses made the right choice. Next one I want to talk about is David. I like this guy. I like everything about him. In 1 Samuel 13, verse 14, and in 16:7, David is called a man after God's own heart. Saul had the King Saul, who was tall, dark, and handsome, and had it all going for him. And he drifted away by making his own sacrifices and then just becoming more and more distant from God as the years went by. There's only two recorded prayers of Saul in the Bible, and there's just hundreds of David's prayers. In 1 Samuel 13, verse 14, it says, "But now the kingdom shall not, your kingdom shall not endure." He's referring to Saul. "The Lord has sought out for himself a man after his own heart." This would be David. "And the Lord has appointed him as a ruler over his people because you have not kept what the Lord had commanded." David had one quality above most men, and that was that he was a man after God's own heart. He put God first. And as I said, David prayed often. 72 Psalms are credited to him. So the first thing we really learn about David is that he was a man after God's own heart. Next, we find out that, you know, he was a handsome lad. But this guy had more brass than a bell. I take it, and I've been reading some archaeological findings, that the average Hebrew man would have been between 5'4 and 5'6. They're not big people. Saul, on the other hand, was over 6 feet tall, and he was head and shoulders above everybody else. So what does that tell you about everybody else? So here's David, this little guy, and he is going to challenge Goliath. Goliath was 9 feet tall. Now, Bill knows, but probably nobody else knows. I used to have some janitorial contracts, and we used to do the downtown Hilton, and I saw all kinds of people in there. Some guy named Nixon. I saw the New York Knicks. I met the Los Angeles Lakers, and one of those Lakers was Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. And he was 7 feet 2 inches, and I had to look up to him. Can you imagine what it'd be like to look up to someone 9 feet tall? And here's little David. But he had this trust in God. And he chided Goliath by saying, "You big uncircumcised Philistine, how dare you challenge the armies of God?" And with that, he took a stone out in his slingshot and killed Goliath. And took Goliath's sword and cut his head off and paraded around town with it. Something we probably wouldn't do today. It would be politically incorrect. And as David became king and he became famous, he was also a generous man. Let's see, do I have to turn this yet? No, not yet. And as he loved Saul, even though Saul kept trying to kill him, and he respected Saul, called him the Lord's anointed, and there's something that I have a little trouble with because I don't happen to like the present, or don't approve of the present president, but using David's example, he is God's anointed. So we should respect him as just that. And that's what David did. He respected Saul as God's anointed, even though Saul was trying to kill him. And on several occasions, David could have killed Saul. After Saul died, David lamented. He said, "How the mighty have fallen. His friend, Saul's son, Jonathan, is dead. All of Saul's family is dead, save Ishbosheth, who became king for 2 years, but he was killed. And that only left one, and that would have been Mephibosheth, Jonathan's crippled son. And he said, "Can I show kindness to him?" And he did. And Mephibosheth regularly ate at the king's table. How would you like to regularly eat at the president's table? That's what that's all about. So David was full of loving kindness. And then in 2 Samuel 11, 2 through 4, he allows the wheels of his kingship to come off. He did it all by himself. This is the story, of course, of his adultery with Bathsheba. He saw Bathsheba bathing on the roof. I don't know about you guys, but I've never done that. And I don't know anybody who does. But maybe in that climate, it was warm. Maybe they didn't have a bathroom like we have bathrooms. But anyway, David saw her, and she was beautiful. So let me ask you, you gentlemen, what do you do if you're standing on your roof and you see the neighbor naked taking a bath? Go back in the house and read a book. Watch TV. Watch the Mariners. Better than watching soccer. But David didn't do that. That was just for cricket. David didn't do that. He let his lust come to full bloom, and he sent over for Bathsheba. I also find it interesting that Bathsheba never says, "No, I'm married. You can't do that." But David, being the king, could have his way, and he did. And he laid with Bathsheba, and she became pregnant, and she told him about it. Bathsheba's husband's name was Uriah, a faithful servant. You look up the story about Uriah, he is a faithful servant. That's a good example for us, to be a faithful servant. And David tried to get, as Uriah came back to Jerusalem, David tried to get him to go to his wife. He says, "Go home." He says, "No, I'll sleep here with my troops." Several times David tried to get Uriah to go home, and he wouldn't do it, because that way he could pin that child on him. But that didn't work. So he did something even sleazier than the adultery he did with Bathsheba, which is sleazy enough. He sent a note with Uriah, his faithful servant, to Joab, the commander of his army, saying that when in the heat of the battle, drop back away from Uriah so he can be killed. And that's what happened. Uriah died. He took his own death warrant to Joab, and such confidence he must have had in David, he'd never think that he would do that. And that's exactly what David did. David had him killed. He didn't do it himself, but he had him killed, as if he had the sword in his hand himself. You know, almost a year passes. The child that Bathsheba's going to have dies. There's his first penalty. But then Nathan, the prophet, comes to David, and he says, "Boy, you done wrong." And my notes get caught up with me here. He tells David of his sin, and he does it by telling him a story about the rich man who had lots of lambs, and then this poor guy over here who only had one. David understood that story, and he says, "This guy should pay back four times for taking that man's ewe lamb." And he says, "You're the guy." You know, that must be just like standing there and taking a punch right to the chin. "Oh, it was me. I did this." And so David realized then that he was the culprit, that this sin is his. And he had Uriah killed, and he committed adultery with Bathsheba. But you know, that wasn't the big crime. That wasn't the big sin. The big sin was, anybody know? The nations around Israel would blaspheme the Lord. That was his big sin. Although if you were Uriah, you might think of it in another way. But the nations around Israel would blaspheme the Lord for having a ruler like that. And they would make fun of him. And David brought down the image of the Lord. And as Nathan was with him, he said, "The sword is never going to leave your house. I can just hear it now. Listen, boy, you in a heap of trouble." Amnon, one of David's sons, raped his half-sister Tamar. Bible says she was beautiful. And that's that's one of those stories that I can kind of read over, because it makes me feel, gives me a tough feeling. This is sometimes tough stuff. By the way, that's one way you can know the Bible's inspired, because it doesn't pull any punches about Amnon and Tamar. He lusted after her, and then once he had her, he hated her. He hated her more than he loved her. And Absalom, Amnon's brother, knew these things.
Tamar.
Oh, I'm sorry. Absalom knew these things. Okay, I didn't get ahead of myself. And 2 years later, Absalom kills Amnon at a sheep shearing. Had his men run him through. So there's two events, actually three, the death of the baby, Tamar being raped, and now Amnon being killed. But it isn't over. And someone might have said to him, was it really worth it? But Absalom tries to take over the kingship. And he gathered up a bunch of men, and David had to leave Jerusalem. You know, band on the run. And he just got out of Dodge in time. And Absalom chased him. And Absalom, it must be, if you could see it, it must be funny, but Absalom was on his donkey and he got his neck caught in a tree. And Joab found him and Joab killed him. Joab and his armor bearers killed him. So now he's lost two sons to violence. After that, shortly after that, and before Absalom is killed, he also, one of the prophecies is that Absalom would make love with all of David's concubines on the roof in a tent for the public to see. That's disgusting, but it's also what he deserved. Terry.
You know, David loved justice for the most part, but he really was blinded by his own flaws. And then, you look at Amnon, that didn't fall too far from the truth. You know, to some degree, he did what his father did. And to some degree, what happened after that is still David's fault, because he didn't meter out justice again. He should have dealt with it, but it headed off that
soul. That's right.
So when you look through this again and again, you see David's kind of still short-sighted when it comes to his own results.
Absolutely. And Absalom was, he had 50 runners going before him and chariots, and he was also a very handsome man, whose hair weighed 6 pounds when they cut it. Never heard of hair, getting your hair cut once a year and having it weigh 6 pounds. But he was also incredibly arrogant. Just the fact that he wanted to take his father's kingdom from him and thinking that he could do a better job than his father. That's arrogant. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Well, I wonder, you know, David had needed out justice with Amnon. What he did to his sister. I don't necessarily think Absalom would have had those feelings towards David. So David, you understand, like, I didn't feel that David kept tripping over his own feet.
Probably. He was probably not the world's best father. By the way, which one of you guys in here is? But you're right, David should have, and when I read that story, I think to myself, David, why didn't you take that boy by the throat and choke him? To think that he could do such a thing. Andrew.
You have to wonder how much the events of Nathan coming to David and telling him, David fully aware now that he had sinned with Bathsheba and killed Uriah the Hittite, how much that influenced his interaction with Amnon and between Amnon and Tamar. Having received mercy at the hand of God, you have to wonder whether that might not have influenced him in his decision not to put Amnon to death.
You're right. That could have entered into it, but I'm not sure. I can't read between the lines like that. But it seems to me like maybe David was slack with his children for years and years. But that's just my understanding. William,
it's tough to be tough on your kids. All of us know that. Always we see the other people not being as tough as they should be with their kids.
Right.
We're always tough enough with our own kids.
Yeah.
That's the good problem. And even though, and as Andrew mentions about God being forbearing with David, yet still he let him suffer these consequences. And yeah, it would have been better for some consequences at least to come down upon Amnon and maybe Absalom would have been.
Maybe not. Mike?
What I'm reflecting on, too, is we're told that David is a man after God's own heart. But when it comes to, you know, God's forbearance toward David and David's seeming, laxity toward Amnon and the justice that should have been meted out in our estimation, there's a huge difference because God told David, this is going to happen to you. This is what's going to go on in your life. This is the consequences. David was silent. He just, you know, this is
he accepted it.
And he expected it to just go away. But that's not the nature of human interaction. Things don't just evaporate into the ether by, you know, putting them behind you, especially when there's parties involved that are, you know, that are deeply offended. I mean, Amnon deeply offended that part of the family by, you know, by raping the sister of Tamar and bringing that disgrace on, you know, his brother. And that was really probably as much Absalom's motivation, because we know he had, his ego was, you know, the size of the Twin Towers. And, you know, so for Amnon to do that to his sister, he was grieved for his sister, but probably just as much enraged that Amnon had disgraced his part of the family.
Right. You know, when I read this story, I ask myself, why would the Holy Spirit put this in here? Why would he put such a tragic story in here? Well, so we can learn from it. You can lust after some woman, and then pretty soon it builds up in your mind. It's so big, you fantasize that you can't take it anymore, and you, like Amnon, he went out and raped her. And, of course, it didn't fulfill his fantasies. How many times does Proverbs say to be satisfied with your own wife? Drink from your own cistern. And I think about that when I used to work with some guys that would do things like that. Another person that gave David grief was a guy named Sheba. Not the Queen of Sheba, just Sheba. And the Bible pulls no punches. It says this man was a fool. But he tried to start a rebellion. He was from the tribe of Benjamin. He tried to start a rebellion. It didn't go anywhere, but still he had given David some grief. And finally, Adonijah, his son, said, I'll be king. Well, David had already said Solomon would be king. So there was more family intrigue there. And in the end, Solomon wound up killing Adonijah, or having him killed. All because David couldn't turn his back and walk in the house. Sad. Cricket, you got a Bible with you? Let's read Psalm 51. Now, after all this happens, David repents. David had this wonderful ability to repent, an ability that by and large King Saul did not have. Psalm 51. This is David's repentance. And if ever, you know, speaking just for myself, if ever I did something so heinous like that, I would hope that I could come up with words similar to this. This is a repentant heart. And this is why David was a man after God's own heart. Go ahead, read on.
Be gracious to me, O God, according to thy loving kindness, according to the greatness of thy compassion, blot out my transgression. Wash me thoroughly from my iniquity and cleanse me from my sin. For I know my transgression and my sin is ever before me. Against thee, thee only, I have sinned and done what is evil in thy sight, so that thou art justified when thou dost speak, and righteous when thou dost judge. Behold, thou hast brought forth an iniquity, and in sin my mother received me. Behold, thou hast desired truth in the innermost being, and in the hidden part thou wilt make me know wisdom. Purify me with hyssop, and I shall be clean. Wash me, and I shall be white as snow. Make me hear joy and gladness, let the bones which thou hast broken rejoice. Hide thy face from my sins, and blot out all my iniquity. Create in me a clean heart, O God, and renew a steadfast spirit within me. Do not cast me away from thy presence, and do not take thy Holy Spirit from me. Restore me the joy of thy salvation, and sustain me with a willing spirit. Then I will teach transgressors thy ways, and sinners will be converted to thee. Deliver me from bloodlessness, O God, for thou God of my salvation. Then my tongue will joyfully sing of thy righteousness. O Lord, open my lips, that my mouth may declare thy praise. For thou dost not delight in sacrifice, otherwise I will give it. Thou art not pleased with burnt offering. The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, and a broken and contrite heart, O God, thou wilt not despise. While thy favor do good to Zion, build the walls of Jerusalem. Then thou wilt provide in the righteous sacrifices, and burnt offering, and whole burnt offering, and young bulls will be offered on thy altar.
Thank you. Does that sound like a broken heart, a contrite heart? If I ever pulled some boneheaded stunt like that, somebody put a Louisville slugger right up against my head. And hopefully then that I would have to say something similar. That is genuinely repentance. Once Absalom is dead, and David didn't want him to die, David said, be kind to Absalom, to the young man Absalom. Now, Joab knew what Absalom was like, and when he had his head caught in a tree, and that must have been sort of a humorous sight, Joab had him killed. And that caused David great grief. And you can imagine that if it was your son, it would cause you the same grief. But David is restored to his kingdom. And then Second Samuel, the first part of First Kings, David dies. He goes home to be with his fathers. But he was a man who loved God, who wanted to do what was right, and yet fell flat on his face and paid a whopping big price for that. But even through that Psalm 51, I read it a couple times today and a couple times yesterday. That is a repentant heart. And that's what David had going for him that Saul didn't. Another person that we could take a look at, pay no attention to that if I miss it, is Saul. The first thing we find out about Saul, not the first thing, but the first thing I wanted to mention is that Saul was incredibly well educated. He went to the school of Gamaliel. That would be comparable to going to Harvard or Oxford or Yale or Stanford. He was well educated. And if I had to pick one, I would say that Saul or Paul is probably the most educated writer in the scriptures. Moses is also, he's a good writer too. It's funny, the more you read this, the more you begin to feel like you know him. But Paul was very well educated. And he had learned Judaism coming and going. He knew all 613 laws. But when Stephen was preaching the gospel, he got arrested. And they hurried him off to the Sanhedrin. And the Sanhedrin is the Jewish Supreme Court. I think Sanhedrin means 50 or 70. So as he was putting forth his defense before these men for his preaching the gospel, he told them the story, their story. Kind of interesting, because as he begins to tell their story, they all go, boy, I like this. You tell it just the way we want. And Stephen was doing a really good job. He probably would have been set free if he'd have kept his mouth shut. But at some point he said, "Ye stiff-necked and uncircumcised of heart." He was speaking to those people, and they didn't appreciate it. And they ran him out and stoned him. And those who were stoning him laid their coats at the feet of a young man named Saul. And Saul was in hearty agreement. He says, "Well done." Boy, he is going to pay a big price. But Saul persecuted the church. In Acts 8, 1 through 3, it says, let me just whip over there and read it to you. Saul was in hearty agreement with putting him to death. And on that day, a great persecution began against the church in Jerusalem. And they were all scattered throughout the regions of Judah and Samaria, except the apostles. And some devout men buried Stephen and made loud lamentations over him. But Saul began ravaging the church, entering house after house and dragging off men and women, and he would put them in prison. He also says in Acts 22, "I put him to death." Yes. I was on a roll, too. Go ahead.
I was thinking on this point you made about Stephen's speech, and he told it, but he told it with a twist. He told it with a twist that they, in their history, God gave them hope and gave them Joseph, and what did the children of Israel do? They rejected him. And God gave them Moses, and what did the children of Israel do? They rejected him.
Yep.
And then, so he showed how, just like you were pointing out, that God, in a sense, recycled those people and showed them that regardless of their rejection of these leaders, God still used them.
Absolutely. The thing about, I didn't want to get into all of what Stephen said because it takes up a whole chapter and we'd be here to this time next week. But he did say something about, which one of the prophets didn't your father stone? When Jesus lamented Jerusalem, and it must have been like a father crying over his son when he said, "Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem." It'd be like maybe Bill's father, they're saying, oh, Bill, how often would I have gathered you like a mother hen would gather chicks, but you wouldn't have it. So now I leave your house desolate. I missed part of that, didn't I? He said, you stoned the prophets and killed those that were sent to her. That was their history. And Stephen just pointed that out to him, and it cost him his life. And Paul sat there and watched that. But on the road in Acts 9, 1 through 16, on the road to Damascus, Saul meets the Lord. And the Lord introduces himself by blinding him. And he said, "Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me?" And Paul said, "Who, me?" And Jesus told him, "Go to Damascus, go to the street called Straight. There you'll meet a man named Annas, and he'll touch you and heal you." So Paul did. He was 3 days blind and in constant prayer. And then Annas came in, laid his hands on him. I think the scriptures say something like scales fell from his eyes. And he was baptized, and he had something to eat. And Annas also, Jesus told Annas, let me turn over here. In chapter 9, in verse 15, it says, "But the Lord said to him, Annas, go, for he is a chosen instrument of mine to bear my name before the Gentiles and kings and the sons of Israel. I will show him how much he must suffer for my name's sake." Now, Paul caused a great deal of heartache to those people in Judea and Samaria. He's the guy you wouldn't want to have come to your door. And now he's going to pay all that back with interest. You might say Paul was a bad guy with a good heart, because once he was taught the gospel, he says, oh, sure, I got it. And that's what Annas did. And he was baptized, and he began to preach the gospel. It took him 3 years, by the way. He went to Arabia for 3 years to get his head straight. But he preached the gospel fervently. He had a chance to go to heaven. How do you like to go to heaven? Just a glimpse. It'd be wonderful. Paul saw the goal, and he never took his eye off of it. But along the way, he paid a price. Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, it's really interesting this approach you're taking, because you think of Paul, probably the single greatest person to do the most harm to the church, at least in that era, right?
Right.
During that particular period of time, becomes the one single person who's done the greatest, given the greatest benefit.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Other than Jesus Christ. And of course, the other apostles, you've got there too, but look at all that he does, look at all that he sacrifices, look at all the writings.
Yeah.
And so what's the lesson for you and me? You know, as we look at our lives and we come up against this huge mistake or sin that we committed, and we think our life is no longer useful for God, and we're just going to be discouraged or depressed the rest of our life. Is that how, that's sometimes how we do it.
Yeah.
But if we take the lesson you're trying to give to us here, it's no, we become like a Saul, and we turn into a Paul, we become the greatest servant.
Yeah. Yep. Get up. Get up, dust yourself off, and let's get going. No. But he persecuted the church with, as John Kennedy would say, with great fervor, with great vigor.
And
well, he was in hearty agreement to put him to death.
There was nothing Paul could learn from somebody like Stephen, because Stephen was just so healed.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you look at today, I've met people who have PhDs in divinity, and they are some of the most close-minded individuals.
Yeah.
When it comes to, you can point out what the scripture says, and their response is basically, I have a PhD, what do you know?
I can read.
Yeah.
No, he had to be humbled. That little bright light there sort of got his attention.
Yeah.
It's interesting. You guys know I'm a history buff. When Hermann Göring was arrested, and some of those other Nazi gangsters were arrested, you know, they thought that the Allies would pin a gold star on them for what they did. After all, we almost rid the world of all these Jews. Good for us! Did work out that way. They all got hung. But they thought they were doing right. And Paul thought what he was doing was right until he was shown differently. And then, of course, Saul, he wouldn't be preaching too much because people would fear him. So his name was changed to Paul. Saul became Paul. In 2 Corinthians 11, I'm going the wrong way. Okay, let's start in 23. These are some of the things that Paul suffered. You wonder if he would have suffered those things if he just would have converted and preached the gospel. But because he was so persistent in persecuting the church, this is some of the prices that he paid. Not all of them, though. Are these servants of Christ? I speak as if insane. I more so, in far more labors, in far more imprisonments, beaten times without number, often in danger of death. 5 times I received from the Jews 39 lashes. 3 times I was beaten with rods. Once I was stoned. 3 times I was shipwrecked. A night and a day have I spent in the deep. I have been on frequent journeys in dangers from rivers, dangers from robbers, dangers from my countrymen, dangers from the Gentiles, dangers in the city, dangers in the wilderness, dangers on the sea, dangers among false brethren. I have been in labor and hardship through many sleepless nights, in hunger and thirst, often without food, in cold and exposure. Those are the things that he had to pay. I will show him the things which he must endure. These things he endured for Christ because of the things he heaped upon his church. But God used this sinner, used this bad guy, because he had a good heart, and he became an excellent evangelist. In fact, the most excellent evangelist there is, there ever was. Yeah, yeah. So the point is that what Bill said, God does recycle us. When we stink it up, you can get up, brush yourself off, be like the publican, Father, forgive me, a sinner, beating his breast. Hey, he was clean. He was good to go. And so are we. Okay, we're out of time. Thank you for your kind attention and your participation. It was enjoyable.